Hi, good morning, everyone. So today we will be having two lectures, so two presentations from Matti Haukka. He's a professor here at the University of Jyväskylä, and I will be following him. So we have two lectures or two presentations of the research that is being done here at the Department of Chemistry. Monday's lecture. Please note that unfortunately we have some illnesses, so I have to cancel Monday's lecture. So two of the lectures are on sick leave. So during Monday, you don't need to show up. You can do the circular now course online and follow up with that. So I will send an email about this also, so everyone will be familiar with the cancellation of Monday's lecture. But now we can start with Matti's presentation. So go ahead, Matti, if you want to.
Yes.
Yeah.
Good morning, everyone. So I'm going to introduce what our group is doing, and especially in the field of circular economy. We do other things as well. I'm originally a catalyst designer, I would say. So I was working with catalysis a lot. But we are also nowadays involved in circular economy. Our group is called EMS Group. That means Extended Molecular Systems. And the idea for the name is that we are not focusing on molecules and activity of molecules. We are trying to build a little bit larger moieties, and that means polymers and continuous solid materials. Here we have bullet points of some of our projects, and we can start with these adsorbent materials. We use a lot of 3D printing for capturing. 3D printing itself is not something we are studying, but it's a useful tool for building filters for removal and capturing either compounds, organic compounds, for example, or ions. Then a few words about upcycling plastic waste. We are also working with electrochemistry. How does that link to circular economy? We are trying to replace mineral graphite by using a biomass-based conductive carbon. Then we are also designing and producing hydrogen storage materials, and then a few words about water purification projects we are working with. So let's start with this 3D printing stuff here. I'll move a little bit so I can show you. I use the pointer on the screen here. So 3D printing materials for capturing or removal compounds or ions. So we are chemists. We are not interested in 3D printing as a technique. We are interested in synthesizing materials which can capture something and which is selective for certain compounds. So if we try to capture some, I don't know, heavy metals from aqueous solution, it just picks up the heavy metals and it's not going to be saturated with other materials. So we are looking for materials which could capture metal ions or inorganic ions. We are looking for adsorbent materials which are able to capture organic compounds, especially pharmaceuticals. And in that field, we have been focusing so far with non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs. And here you can see familiar names of of some of these anti-inflammatory drugs. If we think about purification of wastewater, some of these drugs are not really a big problem, because if we have a proper water wastewater management system, we can get rid of these pharmaceuticals, or some of them quite well, like paracetamol, for example, aspirin. They are not producing the problem from the water purification point of view. But we have a couple of nasty ones, diclofenac and naproxen. They have a tendency to go through our water purification system, and we need to do something about it. And they are widely used. If you use some sort of a, you strain some of your muscles and you get this kind of a cream to kill the pain, it's probably meaning diclofenac what you have there. And it's also used for veterinarian things, this diclofenac, so it's very widely used, and it easily ends up to wastewater. Then one problematic things are hormones. We've been studying estrogens, other hormones as well, but this is one group of hormones we've been looking through recently. So our idea is to find the material which would absorb something, and then we would like to build a real thing which can do it. So we can really put this kind of a physical object in some sort of a purification system. And that's why we are using the 3D printing techniques. So we build our material, use that, and then put that in a 3D printer and print the film. What kind of materials we are working with? When we build our filters, we need some sort of a screw material. In a way, we need some sort of a supporting materials. We can use these classic polymers, for example. We can use nylon. There are different type of nylons. That's called nylon 12. The number just means that carbon atoms between these functional groups. We use polystyrene. We can use polyurethane. But we can also use biopolymers. Another thing what we can do to improve these the absorption properties of these materials, we can functionalize these. This is something we do as well. And hopefully get better absorption properties in the end. If you are not familiar with 3D printing, this is the main technique we use. It's called selective laser sintering. Well, that's the old name for it. It has other names as well, but I tend to use SLS because this is what I normally use when we do this about 10 years ago. So selective laser sintering technique. What does it mean? We have to roll in the powder, it's in a container. The printing area is in between two containers. We have a roller or we have a blade, which first we have to fill the printing area. Then we use the laser and melt some sort of a figure on top of the powder bag. When one layer is done, we use a roller or some sort of a blade to pull new fresh layer of powder on top of the first sinter layer. And we repeat this as many times as we need in order to get the object. So this is the basic principle of selective laser sintering. It's also called powder bed fusion technique. Here's our printer, or our newer printer. We have also an older one, it's called Snow White. On the right hand side, we can see it's open, so we can see the oven there. This is extremely clean at the moment because we put the pictures right after we purchased the device. After a couple of months, it doesn't look like this anymore. So here is the printing area. We have two of these new models. We can print under inner atmosphere in this particular one. For example, we can adjust any parameters in this printer, which is crucial for us because we are using experimental materials. So we need to adjust the laser power, we need to adjust the temperatures and all the parameters for the printer. What is it we do? If we think about these filters, we have several options. We can make filters which have this kind of a printed flow channels. Any shape we would like to have, if we would like to put some sort of glue space, or we can screw this together and put it as well, so anything goes shape-wise. What is the advantage compared to a situation where we just have a block of plastic and we drill holes through it? We can print this kind of a very complicated mesh inside the filter object. Or if we want to have some reason to make odd shape flow channels there, they go straight a little bit, then you have some sort of a larger area. If that's needed, we can do that. And by using other techniques, it's really difficult to do that. And that kind of a structure. But we don't have to necessarily build this kind of channels. We don't want to build separate channels. We can adjust our laser power in such a way that we don't melt these fine polymer particles completely. We melt it as much as we need to make a firm solid object, but not completely. So if you look at the picture in the middle here, this same image, you can see that we still have this particle shaped pieces here which are firmly together, but then we have a lot of holes in the structure which go through the structure. And on the right hand side, we used photosound tables, something like this, or some dye which we just let flow through this kind of a printed object and then break it to see if color is everywhere in the structure. And as you can see, it's rather nicely distributed there. So, two options: either we make the channels or we just adjust the porosity by changing the printing parameters. If you take a closer look, this is how it looks like. These are the polymer particles on the right-hand side, and you can see that there are voids between the particles. In the middle picture here, you can add functional additives in your printing power. Or something which is active. Maybe the polymer is not useful at all in a pure form. One option is that you add something there, print it again, and this is what you come up with. So the active particles, which are in this middle picture shown as a much lighter particles, they are attached on top of these polymer particles, so they are not completely covered by the polymer, they are on top of these particles. They are again rather firmly attached there, but they are available for chemical reactions or if you have adsorbent there, if this active component is adsorbent, it's completely available for doing its job adsorbing stuff, so if it's a catalyst to do catalytic reactions. These are metal particles, just to show how they are in the middle picture, just to show how they are attached to the polymer. On the right hand side, we have an anion exchange resin white stuff. And again, it's not covered by the polymer, it's on top of these polymer particles. Here we have, on the right hand side, we have what we often use in our laboratory, so we make this kind of pellets. We use whatever material we are studying for absorption purposes. We can feed it in for example, syringe, and then push the solution through these filters and see how much they are capturing any different materials. This is, of course, very useful in the laboratory, but in real life, it always happens. No one calls me normally, except when I'm giving a lecture or something like that. Okay. So the next question normally is, but this is such a study thesis. How can you even claim that these are useful in the real world? Well, scaling is straightforward. You just need a little bit bigger printer than what we have. And here's one example which Ari Leisman is holding in this picture. This is a selective gold scavenger designed for the electronic waste. If you dissolve this electronic waste, or normally how it goes is that you burn the organics, you take, let's say, these, what are these, motherboards, you burn them in order to get rid of the resin what you have there, and then dissolve the metals by using something like aporigia or diluted aporigia or something like that. If you do that and pour that solution straight to that kind of paper, you can do that. Normally, it dilutes a little bit, but it's not absolutely necessary. You don't want to do that. What is captured by this particular filter is only the gold. There's a huge amount of copper there. No problem, it goes through. If you want to take that, you can use other techniques and other filters to do that. So you can immediately get a pure fraction of gold containing only gold on one filter. If you have different filters, you can put them together. Filter one takes this filter, filter two takes another one, and so on and so forth. And of course, you can combine this with other techniques. So that's quite a lot of power, about 3D printing technique. But as I said, we use it routinely. We are not interested in 3D printing, but it's an excellent tool to make a real object, real chemically functional object. And one application is used for adsorption purposes. Metal ions is something which has been captured quite a lot in actually Ari's group, and Siri is very familiar with these kind of things. We have been focusing a little bit more in removal of organic compounds and, as I said, pharmaceutical some hormones. A couple of papers has been published in that field. Polyamide, nylon, pure nylon is very useful, not only for capturing gold, but you can use that to capture one of the estrogen hormone, 17 beta estradiol, and it's very good for that. That is very effective for that. Here's another example. We were comparing different type of polymers, pure polymers. What can they do? Can we capture hormones with other polymers than nylon? Yes, it can work, for example, thermoplastic and polyurethane for the purpose as well. And here's just a picture of this first article where definitely more important in this project, how it separated or captured 17 beta estradiol. Very straightforward. And here's also an image of the field that there was no separate flow channels, it was just made porous by adjusting the printing conditions. Now we can go even closer to the circular economy. So we use quite a lot of plastics as a binders for our adsorbents. But we have a project which started in 2022, which is called PlastLife. And our goal in that particular project is that, yes, we use again these polymers to capture stuff, or use them as binders, but instead of using pristine pure following the powers, we start using ways plus. We are looking for suitable plastic waste fractions, which would be relatively easily converted to the active components for our absorbents. This is a rather big project. I think maybe Siri has already mentioned this at some point.
No, I haven't.
No. Siri is also involved in this last lab. There's in addition to us, there are 17 other organizations and companies involved in this plastic project. It's a long project. It started, it says here 2023 to 29, but in fact, it started in December 2022 and it ends end of November 2029. But anyway, it's a 7-year project, but it's a rather long project. What are we doing? I already explained what are we doing. So in that project, we are trying to use certain plastic waste fractions for our purposes to capture either valuable materials or remove harmful stuff from mostly airport solution. And the primary tool after we get the material and probably clean it, the primary tool that we use to make these filters is again 3D print. Here's a first paper which was published under this Glass Life project, and that was about this hormone removal. What we used here was not really a pristine polymer powder, it was recycled from a local 3D printing company. I quickly showed you the technique, what we use this selective laser printing. It unfortunately generates a lot of material which has been heated. I mean, even if you don't need that much plastic to make the object, you have to heat a certain amount of material in order to create this powder bed. And for commercial 3D printing companies, they don't like to reuse that material too many times. So they throw it away. But we use this, their waste material for our purpose. So it's a very small scale recycling of polymers. But what is going on at the moment, and we have a first data on the examination, we also look at the other waste plastic fractions. This is just everyone has seen this. This is the polystyrene foam, which is widely used for packing all kinds of stuff. So we use that for printing filters. It has to be converted in powder form, so it has to be dissolved. We don't have to go all the way to monomers. We don't want to do that. That's the normal way of recycling, for chemical recycling of plastics. But we try to find a shortcut. We are trying to, we are looking for methods which would save energy. So we don't break it up to monomers and then bring it up again to polymers. We try to make a shortcut and use it almost as it is. Well, this is not necessarily the best possible material for our purposes. So what we did was, as I said, we converted it in powder form and then added the carboxylic acid group in that material. And then it worked really, really well for scavenging, not hormones this time, but these anti-inflammatory drugs like they open up and not toxic. Other project which got nothing to do with plastic, we are also involved in a project called BitGain. You can see the long name there. Our role there is we are looking for how to replace mineral graphite with conductive carbon made out of biomass. It's not our invention. It has been done, but it's not. It's a bit tricky. And we are trying to find local biomass sources which could be utilized for this purpose. I just took this table from EU's critical raw material list, and you can see that graphite is one of the raw materials and critical raw materials. And there's another problem. Most of it comes from China, and if there are any political problems with China, with suddenly moves our graphite, what does it mean? We use graphite in our batteries, for example. That's a crucial component there. That's why we are looking for this kind of recycled sources or renewable sources or conductive carbon. It can be almost anything. Here's some sort of seeds, how they produce conductive carbon. I don't like to call it graphite because it's not similarly high quality graphite what we can find when if we are looking at the mineral graphite, but it's still conductive. It's still called graphitization, this process. So what you do is you may have to extract some oil there. You may have to break some other compounds or get rid of some other compounds from your raw material. Then you have to finally activate. Yes, a path to that. So you have your raw material. You have to do something with it. You heat it at some point. To a certain point, I would say that before this catalyst impregnation and graphitization, you have something which is more or less activated carbon or gold carbon. But that's not enough. You can take your activated carbon. You need catalyst, often an iron catalyst. Then you have to go very high temperature, something like 1,000, 1,200 degrees, and then you can get your conductive carbon. And that's the quality of that material is high enough to use in batteries. We are using that in flow battery, but it could be used in good old lithium-ion battery as well. But we are studying flow battery. This is the pyrolysis oven we use. Obviously, we do things in small scale here. And here are the first materials. This is the raw material. It's from the local sawmill there. It's a pine wood sawdust what we do. And here we have the first materials. They have already been analyzed as well. And we can see graphite. There are some of the black graphite there. And we know that it's conductive. This product is also on diamonds. Another thing, it seems to be finished. So another project we are working with is hydrogen storage. So this is simply hydrogen production and storage that involves renewal of industry in central Finland, and that's hydrogen. So we are looking for materials we could use to improve hydrogen storage. People would like to use hydrogen as an energy source, but there are problems. Obviously, the production of hydrogen, there are problems. If you want to generate hydrogen from water, there are problems. If you want to someone else, there are problems. But something which is often overlooked is that you have to store it somewhere as well. And you have a couple of ways to do that. You can use low pressure storage, where the gas pressure is 5 to 20 bars typically. But you need a huge tanks to do that because the energy density is not that high for the gas. So you can compress it along. You can have a smaller container, but then you have a very high pressure, 200 bars or even more. You can liquefy that. It takes energy. So you have problems with the storage. That can be overcome by absorbing hydrogen some sort of a material. One way is this absorption, which is shown in the right-hand side picture. So you make something like, let's say, metal hydrides. But we are not working with that. We are going with the absorption part. So if you, instead of putting your gas in an empty container, if you fill it with highly, highly porous material, which can interact with hydrogen, it doesn't generate chemical bonds, it's a physical absorption. You can lower the storage pressure considerably. And what we do is we use carbon materials there as well. Obviously, we are trying to use biomass to produce this kind of absorbent materials as well, but we could use something else. We are working with other materials as well. For example, metal open brain works. That's a bit tricky thing because often the synthesis are quite expensive in that case. And then we can use zeolites. We use recycled zeolites, which we get from this. Same devices what we use. Since we have for the carbon material production, we use again these pyrolysis oils. We need to measure the surface areas in order to get the surface areas to really get something useful. Another project, what our people are doing is water purification by ferrite oxidation. I'm already almost over time, so I honestly have a little bit. So normally, if you think about water purification, one step there is oxidization. You can do that with UV light, you can do that with ozone, and so on and so forth. What our one of our students is studying is to use this iron 6 ferrate, which is highly, highly oxidative, compound, and effective oxidize all kinds of organisms. So you can use it for all kinds of pollutants. You can use it for disinfection of water. You can use it for odor removal if needed, and you can coagulate certain impurities which are then present. Yes, the process how it works, but I'm not going to go through that. But we end up with this iron 2 compound, and that is something which is present in the iron. Simplify that a lot, we end up having a rust at the bottom of the reaction. So that's rather nice way to do that. There are challenges there. Synthesis of highly reactive iron 6 is not always like this. Then just very, very quickly, slide per project, something which got nothing to do with recycling. We are working with synthesis of metal gels, conducting moves for metal polymers. This one was used, for example, this we have right hand side, the lower right picture. This was used as a this was used for sensing diclofenac in the wastewater. So in that sense, everything is a little. We are studying carbon monoxide releasing molecules. That may sound far strange because we all know that carbon monoxide in reasonable concentrations is obviously toxic, but we all generate a little bit of carbon monoxide in our bodies as well. It's used in certain signal transfer processes, and it's also therapeutic for if you have some sort of a tissue damage, for example. But if you want to find this kind of compound, then it would release carbon monoxide. It has to release suitable amount of it. It has to release it in the right place. And it has to be eventually water soluble. And the final, I think it is the final, yes. The final project which I can mention is the catalysis project. We are generating, we are trying to protect nano-sized metal catalysts. If you have a nano-sized metal catalyst on the surface, let's say some sort of a support surface, when it's heated up, they tend to agglomerate. And in this project, we try to prevent that by generating certain type of encapsulation containers, if I would say. This is one example of that. This is an alumina sphere which is following inside. We also work with polymers, try to encapsulate materials in polymers. And that brings me to the end. This is our EMS group at the moment, unless you will start on the 1st of October. Everyone else is currently working. That's it. I only managed to be 5 minutes there. That's not bad for me.
Thank you, Matthew.
Thank you.
For the questions, comments part, I think this was also a way to move towards green transition as well as circular economy, because lots of your projects
yes.
are involved in these kinds of advances. Let us start. So you were mentioning about these 3D printed scavengers or trying to capture these metals and organic compounds. Can you tell about the, because this is a circular economy, we're talking about circular economy, can they be reused?
Yes, that's the whole point. I mean, if you print something for, let's say, capturing something, it would be total waste of energy if it's only used once. So all the materials are designed in such a way that, yes, they capture under certain conditions, they capture what you want, then you can very easily just wash it out or eliminate it out from this filter and you can reuse. If you can't do that, let's say that you have batch of activated carbon, it's excellent absorbent for most things, but you can't get things out of there. If they are metals, you can burn it and that's it, but you can't reuse. That's we are trying to avoid. So it has to be reusable. And that, in all of these studies, we have used certain amount of certain number of rounds, from 5 to 10, even more rounds, to see what happens to the unsalted properties when you reuse. And most of them work well. Or at least the ones we record, then if it doesn't work, we don't tell anything about that. So it doesn't work. But yes.
Yeah. And then about, because we are, we, because I'm going to say project, you know, I'm asking questions, I already know the answers too, sorry. but when we're working with recovery of metals and organic compounds, it's quite straightforward to think that, okay, we can reuse the metals, but when we wash them out from the scavenger, so we can reuse them, so we get a new product out of it, we can use it. But how about the organic compounds?
Well, I wouldn't recommend that you eat your little thing again if you capture it from wastewater. So that's not the goal. They are mostly, well, first of all, they can be used for purification, so you just get rid of it. But another thing is that even if I mentioned only a couple of organic compounds, you could design this kind of scavengers for something, some valuable organic compounds, which actually can be used for something. I don't know what, I don't have a good example at the moment, but let's say some organic long carbohydrate chain acids or something from a certain type of waste material. Then you isolate it and you have a ready organic product. And you don't have to synthesize everything from the get-go. And even if you capture something like diclofenac, Well, that's not a good one because, as I said, I don't want to eat it again because everybody wants egg. Often people say that if you capture a certain type of organic compound, it's so cheap that there's no point of doing that. But only it's easier to start from the basic chemicals. But this is not always so straightforward because you always have to put energy there and you start synthesizing something. If it's less energy consumption, there's less energy consumption and less chemical consumption when you capture something, when you form some sort of a waste stream, for example, that may be beneficial still. But it depends. It's not so straightforward as in the case of metal ions, which are much more easily used. But if it's possible, that's always the first thing to think. Can we use it for something, or do we just burn it? Like people always do with the organic waste, it's always burned. So if we can use it, we use it. If not, then at least we can use it for purification.
Yeah, that could be a next step to study where we could use the recovered organic compound. Yeah.
But then we have to think about what is it we wanna capture. But there are sources where we do have a very valuable organic compounds, and even if the concentrations are not necessarily extremely high, it still may be worthwhile because some of the organic compounds are expensive and some of them are very difficult to synthesize. It's about design, what we want to capture and what we want to reuse.
How about questions from the audience? I'm going to check the Zoom connections if we have.
I could not put Siri's name in our list of researchers as well, but formally you are an analyst.
Yeah, I'm a double agent.
So the fact is that we are doing so much collaboration within this chemistry department that it's sometimes difficult to remember who this person actually is originally or formally, because you get money from certain projects, you are formally in some service. In some group, but in fact, we are doing all the information.
Yeah, we have a question from the online from Junil. So I think I already asked number one question. He's asking if the compounds or ions is trapped inside, is there a way to remove it so that you can reuse the filter? So we went through that. But there is another question. If you 3D printed the exchange resin, will its functional groups be destroyed?
No.
You need to use a temperature that is
Exactly.
less.
We have done that several times, and we have compared the properties of this printed one with the original one. I mean, the pure one. Obviously, since you use laser or sintering, if you use too much power, you will destroy it. Obviously, you have a 30-watt carbon dioxide, and you can easily burn your compounds if you wish. But as I said, we can adjust all the parameters. You can't print everything, but we have printed several organic compounds. We have even printed pure urea and actually made an object out of it. But in that case, we have had to use a little bit more power, and it's not original in its original form. But with resins, you can do that quite easily. You just have to adjust the printing conditions. And that also means that you have to choose suitable binding material for it. So sometimes your binding material requires certain temperatures in order to be partially melted. If that's too high for your organic compound, then it may destroy. But short answer to that question is no, you don't destroy it. We have also printed metal organic frameworks, COFs, which are covalent organic frameworks, and so on and so forth. So you can print all kinds of stuff if you choose your printing on it.
Yeah. Yeah, then another question. Since the Plast Life project is accommodating different kinds of plastics, do you consider to mix all the plastics, then make adsorbents out of it?
The question is probably, can I use a mixture of plastics in that? Probably I could, but it is challenging. I mean, they have so different melting points and properties that if you just take a bundle of all kind of plastic, it's probably very difficult. You could perhaps get something out of it, but I'm afraid we still need to have some sort of mechanical separation before we choose our waste fraction. That's why I or we started with polyurethane, not polyurethane, polystyrene, because this expanded polystyrene, this foam-like thing, that's usually one of the plastic compounds which is relatively easy to separate with the rest of it. And we all have this kind of packing materials everywhere. So that was an easy choice. But if we go for some waste dump and take a look at the plastics which are there, I don't think we can really work with that kind of nature. So it requires some sort of sort.
Yeah, the sorting is a big part of the to get like a proper fraction. So what we can use, it cannot be a mixture of dirty things and so on. So we need to.
Exactly, but if you go to Plast Life, there are people who are focusing in sorting and separating that kind of materials. That's absolutely crucial. No matter what you do with your plastic, unless you burn everything, then
Yeah.
you don't have to separate anything. But if you want to reuse it one way or the other, you have to separate.
Yeah.
So it's a big problem, unfortunately.
And the next question actually is a continuation on that. So, what do you use to wash the plastic waste collected? I can probably answer this.
You can ask.
Yeah, because we've gotten samples for the Plast Life project from the Finnish Environmental Institute. Yeah. So they have been doing the washing actually, and I saw when I visited them that they were doing water washing with some kind of mixture. So water washing has been what has been done, and actually they have also ground the material to a smaller particle size for us. So we have gotten clean and small particle size plastics to us. So we haven't actually done the pre-treatment ourselves.
Yeah, and it depends on the material where it comes from. We've been recently working with this kind of an artificial grass from football fields. And it's a layered structure. You have this kind of a grass, which is one polymer, then you have this kind of a bouncy layer underneath it. They used to use old car tires there, but it's forbidden nowadays, so it can be even boots, dose of sawdust or something else, or some other polymer that, and we have what fractions of those as well. They also have to be separated. Here's the grass part, here's the bouncy part, this rubbery part, and so on and so forth. So you have to separate, and then how to wash it depends on where it comes from. If you look at some of the huge plastic dumps, everything is put together, they are new, packed in huge cubes. No one knows where they have been. So the washing is really a big problem for them. But this is a big project, and our part is to try to do something after we can get reasonable fractions of replaced plastic waste, and then we have groups who are focusing on washing and all these things. We have used agricultural plastics. We have also samples from those. We have printed even some of those and so on and so on. So we get different type of plastics.
Yeah, thank you. There seems to be no more questions in the chat, so you can still post them if you have any question from
Sure.
the audience. Junie, thanks you.
We had the same project in that particular case. So.
It's good that I didn't add plus life in my own slide because I was thinking you could mention it.
But I have to run into next meeting already.
Yeah. Okay. See you. Thank you. Okay, what do you think? I think we've been looking at lots of projects, lots of stuff. Do we take a 5 minute break at least so we start 10 minutes past? We can run down the up and down the stairs if we want to, so get a little bit of fresh air and then continue 10 past 11. Same for you guys online, so we'll keep a short break here. I will stop the recording, so we will meet 10 past 11. Okay, so let's start. Few people are still missing, but we will start, so we will finish on time. I'm not sure how long this will take, but maybe not half an hour, but let's see. So I don't have a research group of my own. I belong to the research group of Ari Väisänen currently, and but this is a project we had a year ago. So this was a 2 year project, circular economy ecosystem project. So nice to present this project to you today. This was a collaboration project between us and the Natural Resources Institute of Finland, and a 2 year project. And the goal was to use local waste and side streams to produce raw materials. I'm just trying to move this. Maybe I should change this. Don't know how to align it properly. Maybe not. If I stand here. Yeah. And so the waste streams that we used to produce new materials were biowaste, power plant ash, and neodymium magnets. If you're not familiar with neodymium magnets, they are found in your computers, cell phones. Big ones are found in windmills or wind turbines, and they can be reused. And we use these waste products to produce biogas, organic acids, recycled fertilizer, rare earth element concentrate, and iron product. So this is what we did and how we did it. First, to the goals of the project. So we used anaerobic digestion to treat biowaste, which is basically what comes from your kitchen. So when you're chopping vegetables and so on, and you put them in the biowaste, it's in Finland, it's collected separately, and it's being used in anaerobic digestion. So we did small scale testing with this anaerobic digestion, and we used it in a little bit of a different way. Usually you do anaerobic digestion, so you produce biogas and use it. But in this project, we wanted also to produce organic acids on top of the biogas. So that was the goal of the project, to produce these organic acids. Then after the anaerobic digestion, when the biowaste is degraded during the project, there is this digest state or the leftover from the anaerobic digestion, and it can be used as fertilizer. And to the digestate, we added power plant fly ash, which is produced also as a waste fraction of combustion processes. It's in produced in huge volumes, really. So we added the digestate and the ash and saw how it can be used as a fertilizer. Then we utilized these organic acids for metal recovery from magnets. So we got these organic acids from the bio waste, and then we used them for metal recovery. We tried this in a pilot scale, so we did a little bit of bigger testing than in the laboratory scale, so like a cubic meter scale pilot testing. And then building a collaboration network. That's for the finance. They always want us to collaborate and so on. The concept of this ecosystem. So this is a simplified flow chart of what we did. So biowaste, separately collected biowaste from municipal biowaste, so coming from your kitchens. And we did two-phase anaerobic digestion. So this is the acid process, which produces organic acids, also hydrogen. Then we put it into a biogas process, so two stages, anaerobic digestion, so biogas is formed here. And then we are left with the digest state, so what is left after all biogas has been released from the biowaste. Then we added this power plant fly ash to different parts of the process, to the anaerobic digestion process. So we added into the acid process, to the biogas process, and to the leftover digest state to see which would be the most beneficial place to add this ash into. So we tried various places in the process. Then when we have these organic acids, they need to be purified and concentrated before they can be used in this metal recovery process. So we have magnet waste. In this case, we had from laptops the remaining magnets of those. So hard disk drive magnets, and they were dissolved using these purified organic acids. Then we did some chemistry. Not going to go further into that right now. And we got a rare earth element concentrator. So rare earth elements are the valuable elements present in those magnets, mainly neodymium, a little bit of praseodymium, weird sounding elements, but they are very important in magnets and many more applications. So we got the metal concentrate from here and an iron side product. And why do we call this a circular economy ecosystem is the reason that we are these processes, this acid process where we produce these acids and biogas, it has side products that we can use in the metal recovery process and vice versa. So we are producing here, we are using water, so we can return it back into the acid process. We are also producing hydrogen here, and we can return that also into the acid process. And yeah, here we also are producing hydrogen, and it can in turn be used in the biogas process further. So there are different side streams. So if these two processes were side by side, they could use each other's waste streams efficiently. That was the idea. Then if we look at the production of organic acids, how did it work? They were produced from biowaste using these two-stage anaerobic digestion, and the ash addition was used. We can adjust the acidity of the anaerobic digestion process and also enhance the methane production. And in the best case scenario, we got in the pilot testing, we got maximum of 22.6 grams per liter acid content. So that was the highest acid content we got in this test. Actually, sorry, this is in Finnish. So this is acid as grams per liter concentration here. And this is the days, how long the process has been going on. So in the beginning, we don't have any acid, of course. When the process has been ongoing for 4 days, this is acetic acid, this blue one here. So we have almost half of the acids are acetic acid. then a big part is propionic acid, this orange one, and the gray one is butyric acid. And in the following days, we see this dark blue increasing. So here we have very little of capronic acid, but in the following days, so day 11, we are seeing a big bump in the capronic acid concentration. So it depends on how long you keep the process ongoing, what kind of acids are present in the process. But it's always a mixture, so you won't get only one acid, but you will get several acids. But usually, acetic acid is the main component of this process. And we found out that when we added the ash into the anaerobic digestion process, if we added high concentration of acids, the methane production was decreased. And we, of course, don't want that methane or biogas. We want to keep the biogas production at high level because it's a valuable product of this process. So we want to have as high methane production as possible. So we need to have lower ash content. So we cannot add very high ash concentration into the process. It will reduce the methane production. Then for the concentration and purification step, so this was what came out of the anaerobic digestion process. The picture is not very well, but you can see it's very brown, murky-looking liquid. So we cannot use that in metal recovery processes. It's too dirty. We needed to do some concentration and purification for this fraction. We tried microfiltration to purify it. It was successful. We got a clear liquid, but there was no concentration in the acid as is happening. We would like to have a little bit of higher acid concentration. We tried reverse osmosis. 1.5 times was the concentration factor that was achieved, so not really enough for us. Then we tried a combined method where we did precipitation and evaporation method, and we got really good results where we got up to 25 times concentration factors, so really good concentration of the acids, and only 20% of the acids were lost during the process, so recovery was 80%. And this is a picture of the before any pretreatment and then after the precipitation and evaporation method, so you can see it's a clear liquid. So that's what we want for the metal recovery. You can also see here the concentrations of the acid before any treatment. So acetic acid is at 6.5 grams per liter, and after the evaporation, precipitation and evaporation method, we got 162 grams per liter. So we got a really good concentration in that pretreatment method. So we were happy with that. Then we moved on to the leaching. So leaching is where you put the magnet into solution and it dissolves. So we want to dissolve the magnet material to do some chemistry tricks after that to get the metals out. So we wanted to dissolve the magnet material. Here you can see the magnet is at the bottom and we have added acetic acid or this organic acid here. So it's a grayish liquid and a mixture is going on. So it's being dissolved in this picture. So you can see how the dissolution is being done. So we want everything, all of the magnets to dissolve into this organic acid. We tried leaching with those organic acids without any concentration procedures. We got really low leaching efficiency, basically zero. So nothing was leached if we didn't do any concentration procedures. And for reverse osmosis, the concentration of the acids was not enough. Here we have a table showing the Teaching efficiency, so this is neodymium, the rare earth element which we are most interested in. So only 30 to 55% of leaching efficiency with the reverse osmosis treated organic acids. For the iron, iron is another main component in the magnets. So roughly half of the iron was dissolved. We got good results with this precipitation and evaporation method. So this is an undiluted liquid which we used in the leaching, and we got everything, all of the magnet was dissolved. That's what we are aiming for. We also tried to dilute it threefold, and we almost got everything dissolving also in this diluted acid. So it seems to be working efficiently here. Then a little bit of chemistry here, the developed metal recovery process. So first of all, when you're trying to recover the metal from magnets, you need to treat the magnets somehow because they are magnetic. They're stuck into each other, and if you have any metal, other metals around, they will stuck into anything. They're strong magnets. So we need to demagnetize them by heating them up so the magnetism is lost. And then we ground them in a mill, and then we get this fine powder. And why we want to get the powder is just to increase the surface area of the magnet so the acid can really have a good effect on the magnet. And here we can see this acetic acid leaching or organic acid leaching going on. And after the leaching is done, you see a brownish liquid. And the brownish liquid is because there is lots of iron in the liquid still, and we want to get rid of the iron. We do not want to get the iron. We want to get it out to separate it from the neodymium, which is the valuable element. And here we are separating the iron using oxidative precipitation. So we are basically bubbling air through the liquid. It's that simple. And then do it for a couple of hours so we get iron oxyhydroxide precipitate here. And after that, the liquid is pretty much clear, so no iron is remaining. And after that, we can remove the rare earth elements, mainly neodymium, by precipitating with oxalic acid, which is actually an organic acid itself. But in this stage, we are using a store-bought oxalic acid for this. This a process because we don't get oxalic acid from the anaerobic digesting process. Then we can turn it into rare earth oxides, which is the commonly sellable rare earth element form. So this is a concentrate of rare earth elements here that we got out. Then I mentioned that we are using this fertilizer, or this digested NS as fertilizer. So we looked at what is remaining after the anaerobic digestion process. So we are using it as a fertilizer. So we tried mustard and grow it in a poor soil and then fertilize it with this digested NS to see how it works as a fertilizer. We saw that the biomass was increased when this digestate NS was used, and this digestate contains high amounts of nitrogen. So that's basically the reason for the biomass increase. And we saw that when the ash was added, also flowering and germination were increased. So when fly ash is being added, it contains trace elements, minor nutrients into the system, so they are beneficial for the growth of plants and flowering also. And we saw that even compared to commercial fertilizers, we used two liquid fertilizers in this, but the results were even better with our recycled fertilizer, so to speak. So this digested and us. And what we thought was the reason behind why we got better results than commercial fertilizers is because we are adding organic matter into this poor soil. So when we have liquid fertilizer, you are not adding any organic material into the system, but when you are adding this digestate, you are adding organic matter, so that increases the germination and flowering. These are some pictures of our trials, growing trials. So this is the control sample, which is the poor soil sample. We did it by buying like a compost mix from the store and then adding sand into it until it resembled a poor soil, like a finished poor soil, low nutrient poor soil. And then we added this digestate and also digestate with ash. So you can see here that the plants are very thin, and the biomass, you can see it from the picture, even that the biomass content is lower in this, and the plants look quite flimsy. The digestate increased the biomass, and with the ash addition, even more biomass was found in the plants, and the flowering was also increased. So good results on that. But actually, I have to mention that Finnish legislation is pretty strict. So if you try to do this like make it into a commercial thing, you probably would have problems with the legislation. So you can do it. You can do it at the university level, you can study, but legislation is really strict on these currently. And the heavy metal concentrations were below national limits. We checked it because you may know that ash contains some heavy elements that could be possibly accumulated in the plant. So we wanted to check that after the ash addition, we are not introducing any heavy elements into the plants, which could be used as a food source. So the heavy elemental concentrations were not increased by this. Then we did little bit of calculation on what does this process look. So this is an alternative A. So this is a basic biowaste treatment process done in Finland currently. So anaerobic digestion, we produce biogas, and that's it. We use it for transport. So biowaste coming in at 14,000 tons per year. And the investment price for this kind of process is 3.8 million euros. Alternative B was our proposed method. So biomass coming in at the same volumes yearly. But this is a two-stage process. And the end products are these organic acids, which are used for the metal process, and a biomethane is used for transport use. This investment price for this is almost 5 million euros because this is a more complicated process, so it costs more. Investment aid for this is a little bit higher than for the traditional process. Then, if we look at operating costs, they are higher in this process that we are proposing because this is a two-stage process, it's more complicated. And the same goes for the profits, actually, and the revenue. So, the traditional process is looking better in this case, so it has better profit, better revenue, better balance. But the profit is actually pretty okay also in the two-stage process, but it's not as good as the traditional process. But this is based on very small pilot scale testing, so we are not giving up yet. So we want to do a bigger scale testing to see what would be the case then. So in the next stage, we would like to do in a real facility which is doing anaerobic digestion to do this piloting of organic acid production. It would be nice to see it in a bigger scale to see how it works, what are the impacts on biogas production, how about on the digestate state, and do a more detailed financial statement. And then we would like to do optimizations for the concentration process because we didn't have much time for that. We got good results only very late in the project, so we didn't have time to optimize this precipitation and evaporation method. So we actually have a funding call going on now, which we are waiting for results. We got new projects for this to do this concentration process properly. And we didn't have time to do the financial statement for the meta recovery process, so that was left out of the last project. Yeah, that's it for that project. So any questions, comments on this? I'm sorry for I know some of you people online heard this at summer school a few weeks ago or a month ago. So sorry for the repetition, but I had a few new slides, so maybe not exactly the same presentation as last time. I will check the online. Online also. Okay, we have a new question from Lakshmi. Thank you. What type of reagents are used in oxidative precipitation? Actually, it's just we are not using reagents. We are just using air, bubbling air through the system. Yeah, I may have to add something. We are using because we had a foaming problem in the system. If we are only using this air bubbling, we added octanol into the system a little bit to help with the foaming problems. So that's the only chemical we added. And that is actually one of the things we would need to optimize still, this iron precipitation, to how to make it. Even though we are not adding much octanol, when I looked at the finances of the process, we would need to optimize the octanol amount because it was really costing quite a lot, this octanol. Then second question, if it's sodium hydroxide, yeah, we're not using sodium hydroxide, but where does it end? This octanol, yeah, that would actually be one of the problems. If we add octanol, where does it end up in the process? Yeah, we haven't looked at it yet, how to optimize the octanol amount and what would we do with it afterwards. Is the product was iron oxyhydroxide? Yeah. Iron products are not very valuable, I have to say. You're asking, is it commercially saleable and what are the typical application of this iron oxyhydroxide? I'm not entirely sure what are the current applications for it, but iron products are very cheap and iron is in any case, it's an element that we just want to get rid of. So if we just get some money out of it, we would be really happy, but it's just something we would like to get rid of. And I think many research groups are struggling with this iron removal. So that's one case we need to pay a lot of attention to, how to remove the iron efficiently from systems like this. Yeah, I hope I answered your questions. Yeah. Thank you, Lakshmi. Any questions from the audience? Seems to be quiet here. I hope you haven't been scared off by the chemistry of this lecture. So hopefully you have understood something, even though you have different backgrounds. And the online course Circular Now doesn't involve this much chemistry as we have had today, but and I have told the other lecturers that there are different background people here, so please keep it understandable to others than chemistry people. So we'll try our best, but I would like also for you to tell me what do you feel about the course, because this is the first time we are doing this course, so it's the first time ever. So it would be nice to have your feedback on what do you think. And at the end of the course, we will of course have like this questionnaire on how did you like it. But if you tell me now, I can do changes now. But if you give the feedback at the end of the course, it will be for the next year's people attending the course. So any way you like to give feedback, that's fine. Yeah. No more questions from the chat, it seems. And we can close today if we're ready here. So Monday's lecture will be cancelled, unfortunately. So we will see you next Wednesday, and I will put up the group work topics to the Moodle maybe next week. So you will have time to look at them in advance. And if some of you cannot make it to the Wednesday's lecture, I have at least one people telling me that they cannot make it. So I will form groups of those people who cannot make it to Wednesday's lecture if that's the case. But otherwise, we can form the groups then. And if you have teammates here, you can all already form groups if you want to. But yeah, that's for today. Thank you. See you next week. Thank you, online participants. See you next week.
Thank you, Siri.
Thank you, Sri.
Thank you,
Janil.